on general relativity done in the loop quantum gravity way. And I hope that at least this idea that you have something called irreducible representation for the group, and that these are labeled by half integer numbers, sometimes called spin numbers, passed on you, I hope. So anyway, let me now finish this detour, go back to where we started it, which was at the point where I told you how the key step towards the loop quantum gravity theory was the discovery by Ashtekar that you can actually make a canonical transformation in the original formulation of the theory, such that the canonically conjugated variables you're using now look like a generalization of electromagnetism, where you still have a vector potential and you have an electric field. But now these quantities, they also pick up an extra index, which is this one I and j that goes from 1 to 3. And the generalization can be understood in terms of SU2 as follows. We said, for instance, we considered, you remember, the Wilson line to be the line integral in the electromagnetic field. We consider the line for the Wilson line, it would be just a generic line. For the Wilson loop, it would be a closed line. But anyway, we consider the exponential of this line integral of A, of the connection. And now, because there's this index I here, we can consider a very similar object, where now this index I here is contracted with a generator of SU2. You remember how I told you that group elements in SU2 can be parametrized as the exponential of some parameters times the generators. And there's sum over I here, from 1 to 3, and here as well. OK? So now this, it's a matrix. It's in general representation of the group SU2, as I tried to explain to you the other time. So this here is the exponential of a matrix, which is a matrix itself. One thing that we learned how to do in the case of electromagnetism was how to consider gauge invariant states, right? You remember that we were interested in wave functionals that would be invariant under gauge transformations, namely physical states should be independent under this translation here, where alpha was a scalar field. And we realized that these can be imposed explicitly by just considering Wilson loops on a closed path. So, sorry, this Wilson line on a closed path, namely on a loop. And for this reason, they're called Wilson loops. Okay, those were gauge invariant states. We can do the same in this case, and we are interested in doing the same, because once you do this canonical transformation to the theory, remember how in the initial theory, the Hamiltonian formalism was characterized by the fact that all we had to deal with were a set of four constraints, right, which I had written as this super Hamilton. Well, I didn't really give name to these constraints, so I won't. Even now, for the moment, you remember that this was all we had to do, solve these constraints classically. And the problem with them is that they're highly nonlinear already at the classical level, and so it's a complicated problem. And at the quantum level, we were trying to implement them with the Dirac procedure, namely as restrictions on the physical wave functionals, precisely as we would do in here. Once you do this canonical transformation, what happens is that the theory picks up, the set of constraints now is enlarged. You have, again, a constraint that looks like that it's a scalar constraint like this one, but in terms of the new variables. You have a vector constraint like this one.
Their explicit expression, of course, is different, but it's just the canonical transformation of these functions here. And then you also pick up a constraint, dAEAI equals 0, which is a set of three constraints. There's a sum of array, as usual, implicit in here, which is the precise analog of the Gauss constraint, but in this case, well, in this light generalization of electromagnetism, where the connection is not abelian. Here, for electromagnetism, we saw that to solving that constraint, simply meant imposing this condition, and that could be done by taking Wilson loops. So similarly, we can proceed in the same way in our case, and this constraint here can be solved by starting from functionals of A, and then just taking Wilson loops as a basis in this Hilbert space here, okay, the solution. So the logic would be that, you remember we discussed that when you have a system like this, you start from some kind of auxiliary Hilbert space, and then you impose the constraint, and you get just the physical states which belong to a subspace, let's call it phase. In our case, we have to repeat this procedure three times for all three sets of constraints. So we are going to start from generic wave functionals of A, just as we did in electromagnetism, and our initial belonging to our initial Hilbert space. Then we project into the subspace that satisfies the Gauss constraint, which let me call just big G. So we impose this set of three constraints, and this we know how to do it. Let me call it H0, because these, you just take closed paths, so you take the Wilson loops. And one thing that you have to do is that, because now this is a matrix, in order to be gauge invariant, so in order to be in H0, you want to take gamma closed loop, but also the trace of the resulting matrix. Because you know that the trace of a matrix is a property that is invariant under unitary transformations, right? As well as the determinant. So that should be rather intuitive. So we know that this step can be solved by going to a base of states that look like this. But in order to achieve the full program, that is called the Dirac program of imposing the constraints, we need more steps. We need to impose this vector constraint here and get to some other subspace. Let me call it HD. And then we finally impose the last scalar constraint. And we finally get the physical Hilbert space. Okay, so this step, I hope I've convinced you that you have the tools to deal with it. This step I'm going to show you today how can also be achieved. And this final step is the key open question, is the hardest part of the program. And the reason why it's so hard is that, as I mentioned earlier, this constraint here is now nonlinear. So, so this is the logic of the program. Before going to do this next step, I would like to discuss the origin of spin networks, which has to do with the fact that this is not exactly a clever basis to use in this Hilbert space. The reason why it's not a clever basis is that there are identities among these states. For instance, let me consider along the line integral of this SU2 connection along some line gamma. And as I said, this is a representation of the group SU2. Let me assume from now on, for simplicity, to be working in the fundamental representation. So I can think of this as a 2x2 matrix, which acts on a two-dimensional vector space. So the fundamental representation is called the 1/2, using this notation with spins. as dimension 2, because remember that the dimension is 2j plus 1, and the basis is indicated as 1 half to remember the representation I'm working with, and then m, where m can be up and down, or plus and minus, or 1 half and minus 1 half, according to your favorite notation. So let me call this matrix, and these are 2 by 2 matrix, so let me call it U gamma AB, where A and B go from 1 to 2, or if you want, more closer to the spirit of this notation here, A and B would be minus 1/2 and 1/2. This is thinking of them more as normal matrix indices, and this is more when you think of them in the Dirac bracket notation, okay? But please, there shouldn't be any confusion in this. So these would be associated to, let's say, a line integral gamma from the initial to the final point. And for instance, if I now want to reverse the direction, reversing the direction of a line integral simply means switching the extrema, so putting a minus sign there. So all I'm, so what I'm looking at, so if this is associated with this line integral, this would be associated with the inverse element. So for instance, if you consider a loop gamma, and then you add to this loop a line, let's say alpha, and in order to keep the path closed, you of course have to go along this extra path in one way, and then you have to come back, but you're coming back along the same. But then you see that once you consider the Wilson loop associated with gamma union alpha minus 1, this would be something like the trace of U gamma AB, U alpha BC, U alpha minus 1 CA. Well, by using CA, I have already implemented the trace, right? See, this is just the trace of the product of 3 matrices. And so because this is just the inverse of this matrix here, this gives me an identity. And so this is equal to U gamma AA, namely this is equal to the Wilson loop of gamma alone. So there are identities. This one in particular is called the retracing identity. There is a more interesting one that is one of your exercises. And has to do with the fact that for a 2 by 2 matrix, if this 2 by 2 matrix belongs to the group SU2, its characteristic is the fact that its determinant has to be equal to 1, and the determinant of this matrix, that UAB, I can write it as U11, U22 minus U12 squared. And now I'm going to introduce a funny notation for this. I can write this as UA, what letters am I going to use here? UAB, UCD, and then I need a 1/2 here, and then I can write this as delta, so I can write this as, I want these two indices to be the same, so I can write this as delta BA, delta BC, and then I'm getting this piece, and then in order to get that piece there, I'm going to get, and I want delta AC and delta BD, okay? Alternatively, I can also, where these are just identity matrices, okay? So you see now there's summations over all these letters here, right? So you see that what's happening is that here I'm considering the case 1, 1. When I'm summing over these, they have to be the same. So 1, 1 plus 2, 2. And this is as well this is the way. Well, I think this is a perfect case in which one gets lost in front of the blackboard. Hey, thank you very much. Yeah, yes, exactly. So you see, where the instructor fails, you guys should actually do better with this guy here. Yeah, in fact, that's what was worrying me. Okay, so guys, do this as an exercise, please. Because anyway, what I care of is not this one form, but the fact that there's also another form that I can use to write down the determinant. And this is introducing a new, so this is just the identity matrix. Delta AB is equal to 1, 0, 0, 1, the identity. Let me now introduce another matrix, epsilon, which is given by 0 minus 1, 1, 0, OK? And now I can use this matrix to write the same quantity, BD, UAB, UCD. And now I'm not even going to try to prove this one, given the success that I just had. But you can now look at this equality and extract something that I'm going to write in another blackboard because I will need it. And you can extract the fact that epsilon AC epsilon BD is equal to delta AB delta CD minus delta AC delta BD. And this is called the spinorial identity. In some literature. And sorry, first of all, something that you get for free out of this expression is the fact that you can write the inverse BA using these epsilons as AC BD UCD. And you should verify that when you contract with U, let's say CB, and you're summing over B, then thanks to the fact that you're reproducing the form for the determinant, you're just going to get the unity matrix, so that this is truly the inverse. So what I'm going to do is that I'm going to now give a pictorial representation of this algebraic relation here. And to do so, I'm going to say, I'm going to use the following notation. And the matrix UAB, I'm going to represent it as a line with a blob that tells me that the matrix inside is U. And then an index B here and an index A there. In this notation, the unity, the identity, sorry, delta AB would be the same line from A to B with an identity there. And in this simple case, I will just draw a straight line, OK? Then this equation here can be written. This is a delta AB. So AB. And then there's another one, CD. Then there's a minus sign. And this time, A is connected. Oh, this can be right. what happened to my indices. AC So I need to permute these two, so this should be AB and then BC, okay? So that's why I'm putting them one up and one down so that I can always keep track of the right positioning of these indices, okay? So also these should be now corrected. C, and then I have D and B. And now these two are up and these two are down, so now it's consistent. Sorry about that. So now you see that A here is now connected to D. So A is connected to D. Oops. So this is the identity, and now I'm gonna give the pictorial representation, whereas B is connected to C. And this is equal to A being connected directly to C, and B being connected directly to D. Using this pictorial representation, it's easy to introduce another identity satisfied by the Wilson loops, which is the following. Suppose you have now two different loops, but then at some point they are sharing a piece here. And of course, I should orient these, and I'm going to call this one loop here alpha, and this other loop here, which is oriented this way, beta, and they have this tract in common. And using the spinorial identity, I can write this as, I can imagine these as being two parallel lines. So being that case there, the intermediate case. And then I can write as the sum of those two cases, okay? So let me look first at that case there. So in that case, what's happening is that this is getting crossed. So I'm coming from alpha, and I'm actually crossing over to beta, which has been followed in the same orientation. And here is alpha. So I'm still doing alpha and beta consistently with the orientation, and then plus, so you see, I'm applying the spinorial identity to this piece here. Two parallel, it's equal to crossing plus these two cusps. When I take the case with the two cusps, what I get is that alpha then goes into beta minus one, because as you see now, I'm going the wrong way around beta, and then alpha. This identity between Wilson loops, that it's fun to draw like this, is actually just a consequence of the fact that we are working with SU2 matrices. So one of your exercises is to actually show that this is true using the real algebraic expression, not just the pictures, okay? So that you get an idea that there's actually, the picture is just a convenient way to draw some algebraic properties, okay? So in general, these identities sometimes were in the past were called also Mandelstam identities, because we also generalized them to other gauge groups. However, the moral in here is the fact that these Wilson loops are not all independent. They do satisfy identities like this, so it is convenient in order to describe a basis in the Hilbert space that solves this constraint. It's interesting to find a basis which is not over complete like this one, but a real basis. And this can be done using the theory for SU2 that we developed the other day. And so for instance, I told you how when you take the tensor product of two irreducible representation in the spin 1/2, you probably know already from quantum mechanics that this decomposes into two irreducible representations. So this tensor product is not an irreducible representation, but it can be reduced. So we are going to make use of this property to try to reduce our base, our basis. And so, for instance, if you have the same loop alpha, you could be going around it one time or two times or many times, and according to this, you would be looking at Wilson loops that would be trace of e to the alpha, sorry, trace of e to the line integral over alpha of a, or trace of e to the 2, because you've gone around it twice, and so on. And the idea that was pioneered by Penrose was to introduce a basis which is given by the reducible representations of SU2 only. So all you're going to consider, instead of various powers of the Wilson line always in the fundamental representation, let me use an explicit notation, you're going to consider the Wilson line in a generic irreducible representation J. So this is for a single graph. Okay, so the idea behind this is just this decomposition. And if you're going around the same loop more than one time, you can think of it as if you are considering a tensor product of matrices of SU2. And this you can decompose it into irreducible representations like this. So if you only look at the irreducible Wilson loops, that should be enough on a given graph alpha to reproduce all the others. However, what if the graph is more complicated now? So for instance, here, a new one. So let me introduce a convenient notation. So this would be the Wilson loop, oh, sorry about this camera. The Wilson loop associated with alpha in the basis J. In fact, let me use a more suggesting notation of what I'm going to use later on. So I'm going to call it now alpha J. And this is the trace of the representation of the group element in the spin irreducible representation J. Okay? So with D, I indicate that I'm taking a representation of this group element in the irreducible vector space J. So this is a matrix, and of this matrix D, I'm taking the trace, okay? Suppose now I have a slightly more complicated case, which I have, and to shorten my notation, let me call this group element just G associated with alpha. So let's suppose now I have three, I have a more complicated graph now, instead of being done, being made by just one loop, it's made by actually three lines connected in two vertices so that the whole graph is closed. So this would be this graph here, and I'm expanding so that I can add the group elements in there as by the pictorial notation I've introduced, because in principle these three could be different, because they feel the connection or this generalized electromagnetic field in different points. And then each of these is going to give me a matrix like that. I choose a representation J1 because it's like choosing a base for that link. So for the first link, I choose a representation J1. And then I have the group element G1 associated with it. This is a matrix. Then I have another matrix. So using our notation, this matrix will have indices. You remember we said that we're going to use this Dirac notation. This is the representation matrix, okay? J2 of G2, and this also has indices. And finally, J3 of G3, M3, and 3. Okay, so all these indices are free for the moment. These are just three matrices. And what I want to do is to consider now a state which has these objects in it, but which is gauge invariant, namely, it does not change under action of SU2. In the case of a single matrix of SU2, that could be easily achieved by just taking the trace, because the trace is invariant under change of basis, namely under actions of SU2, okay? However, in our case, now that we have three matrices, taking the product of these three, just the row, the naive idea of just taking the row by column product of these three and then taking the trace would not work. We need something slightly more sophisticated, which is something that I hope you had already seen, but they are precisely those Clebsch-Gordan coefficients that we introduced the other day. You remember we introduced the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients as the decomposition of, let's say, I do this tensor product here, and this decomposes into a sum from J1 plus J2 to J1 minus J2, and then a sum over M from minus J to J of the new base vectors, right? So these coefficients here, not precisely these coefficients here, but something very closely related to these coefficients here, is what we are going to need to play our game here. In order, technically speaking, in order to be able to use these coefficients here, I should make sure that I put my arrows in a particular way, which is this one. If I do that, then I can use directly those coefficients in the following way. This is summed, is not summed over J1, J2, and J3, because remember that J1, J2, and J3 corresponds to a choice of base vector. But it is summed over the index labels, or over the, sorry, row and column indices. So the m's and the n's. So sum over m1, m2, m3, m1, m2, and 3. This is now a gauge invariant state. It depends on the chosen graph. So let's say gamma. Let's say this is gamma. It depends on the three spins. So let's say ji from the where I goes from 1 to 3 in this case, or let's just write explicitly. J1, J2, and J3. And then it's a function of the connection of A in this following way, namely it is the exponential of the line integral of the connection. So I can just write for brevity J1, J2, and J3. Okay. So this is an example of what is called the spin network state. You should think of these, once again, by analogy with the harmonic oscillator. When you think of the wave function of the harmonic oscillator as a state in a particular choice of configuration variables. Here, the state is labeled by a choice of graph and the assignment of three half integers or spins. And then this is the representation, is the configuration space you're looking at, namely the connection. Remember that by G, I simply mean the exponential of the line integral of the connection. One definition that you're going to need for your last, for your exercise is the fact that when you take the particular value, let's say you have that spin network there, so J1, J2, and J3, if you now take the identity for all three group elements, it doesn't matter in which representation you are, but for any representation, the representation matrix of the identity is always, so M, N is always the identity matrix. The only thing that changes is the dimension of this identity matrix, okay? Because remember that when I say J in here, I mean that I'm looking at a vector space of dimension 2J plus 1. So by increasing J, I'm increasing the dimension of this vector space. The representation of the identity element of the group is always an identity matrix. So if I do that, I get delta here, and delta there, and all I'm doing is contracting these Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So this would be sums over M1, M2, and M3. Of these contracted Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. So this is a number, and this number, well, a number, this is a function of J1, J2, and J3. For fixed, J1, J2, and J3 is a number, and that number is called the evaluation of the spin network. So the reason why I introduced this spin network state is because I was after a choice of basis for this Hilbert space here that was more convenient than Wilson loops. And so from Wilson loops, we go to the spin network states, which are now function not just of gamma, but also on a set of spins associated with each link. With each link of my graph, I'm associating a spin. And for this kind of graph, that's all it takes. However, the situation gets more interesting if I consider graphs which have, notice that this graph here has two nodes, but these nodes have valency three, namely there's three links coming out of them, okay? The situation becomes more interesting if I have a node with valency four or higher. And what happens in that case is that I will need at this point to erase someplace, maybe here. What happens in that case is that you have some extra freedom in choosing a gauge invariant state. Namely, for a graph like this, the only gauge invariant state, you just take the trace. For a graph like that, the only gauge invariant state is you take the Clebsch-Gordans to contract the indices. And this is unique. However, you start to have freedom when you consider vertices which have valency four. So if I were to consider a graph very similar to that one, but this time where the vertices have, where the nodes have valency four, then in this case you get an extra freedom, and depending on the dimensions of these vector spaces here, you might have extra labels to associate here. This can be understood in a simpler way, in a very simple way. What the Clebsch-Gordan condition do for you? Remember what was the meaning of the Clebsch-Gordan was that if you're adding up two angular momenta, J1 and J2, the final angular momentum you can have in here, let's call it J3, must lie between the values J1 plus J2, J1 minus J2, okay? These can be also seen as the fact that if you are with J3 within these limits, then you can construct a gauge invariant state associated to these three products here. For instance, let us consider a simple case when this is just one half, and this is just one half, then you know that this one can be zero or one. Let us take one. If I take one, then I also know that one vector, sorry, tensor one half, among these, the decomposition of these into irreducible representation, there is a singlet, a gauge invariant irreducible representation. You know how to do this. One crossed one half gives you a three half using this rule, or a one half. And then you have to take the tensor product with one half again. When you take the tensor product with three halves, you get five halves plus I'm adding one half. So when I'm adding one half to this, I'm getting two. When I'm subtracting one half, I'm getting one. And then I'm taking the tensor product with this one half, which when I add them gives me another one. And when I subtract, gives me a zero. Zero means that it's a singlet state, means that it's invariant under the group, under direction of the group, right? It's a one-dimensional representation. So if you satisfy the Clebsch-Gordan condition reversely, you can think of these as the fact that you have chosen three such that in the tensor product of those three, there is one singlet representation. And when the vertex is trivalent, the node is trivalent, you either get one or you get none. So if you don't satisfy the Clebsch-Gordan conditions, there's no possibility of taking this tensor product and getting a singlet irreducible representation. If it does satisfy, there's only one coming out of it. But what happens if now the vertex is four valent? So I have a one half, one half, one half, and one half. Well, now when I take the tensor product of these four guys, and again we do it step by step. So these first two gives me 1 plus 0. So 1 plus 0. Then I do this multiplication here. This multiplication still I have to do it. I'm doing this one. I get 3 halves plus 1 half plus 1 half. And when I do the final one, I get 2 plus 1. And then I'm acting there. I get another 1 and a 0 from these two. And then from these two, I'm getting again a 1 and a 0. So there are two possible singlet spaces. Okay? So when you are dealing with a node of valency higher than 3, you have additional freedom in specifying which singlet space your Clebsch-Gordan coefficients are now picking up. So if you had a graph like that, the spin network function associated with it would be the product for all the four links of the four matrices, each of them in its own representation, chosen by the spin associated to the links, and each with its own free indices. And then this is going to be contracted by the product over the two nodes that I have of Clebsch-Gordan coefficients, which now are going to contract the m's and the n's, but they also depend on this choice here. And traditionally, because traditionally you can label the basis that gives you the various choices, again, using half integers. But to remind us that these half integers are not the same as the links, we use I as a notation, okay? So I is associated to the nodes. It's an half integer associated to the nodes. J is an half integer associated to the links. And so if I want to fully characterize a spin network state in general for a graph of arbitrary valency, I also have to assign these intertwiner numbers, that's what they're called, to each node. And then this is a function of all the JL. Oh, and notice that in this case of for valency, I don't have to give more details about this. I also have realized that I have this, perfect. Okay, so in the last half an hour or so, there's at least two things that I would like to give to you. One is what is the meaning of these states? And the second is how can you do these two steps? So first of all, let me discuss, even though these states are not physical, for what I've said, it's like if in electromagnetism you were looking at states which were not gauge invariant. These are not yet physical because they're not implementing the constraints of general relativity, okay? But nevertheless, let's try to understand what is their interpretation. For instance, these states here, they have a very nice interpretation. They are the states that are stationary. They are the eigenstates of the energy, right? So they have a very nice physical interpretation. Can this be given a similar interpretation? Yes, and it's a very beautiful interpretation that requires, so typically you characterize your basis by saying which is the quantum observable that is diagonalized in this basis. Here, this is the basis that diagonalizes the energy, right? Here, I cannot really talk about observables because I'm not talking about physical states yet. But nevertheless, sometimes one uses the convention of calling these kinematical observables. Namely, it's before studying the dynamics, okay? So what are the operators? Let me use just, in order to avoid discussions, what are the operators that are diagonalized by these bases? Well, the nice thing is that the operators that are diagonalized by these bases are operators that correspond to geometrical operators. And the spectrum of these geometrical operators in that basis turns out to be discrete. Precisely, like this basis here diagonalizes the energy of an harmonic oscillator, and the spectrum of this operator turns out to be discrete. Okay, so in a very similar way, this happens also in this formulation of general relativity. You can give at this kinematical level a basis of states and characterize them by the fact that they diagonalize geometric operators. It's not hard to see why this happens. So I'll try to give you a feeling of it. And you will need one extra notion of group theory that I'm afraid from what I've seen the other time you probably haven't heard yet. But it's the fact that there is a very nice gauge invariant operator that can be constructed out of the generators of SU2, and this is called the Casimir operator. And by gauge invariant, it means that if you are in a reducible representation, that is just a number times the identity matrix. It's not rotated, okay? It's just the identity matrix. And that is called C for Casimir, and with a 2 because it's a quadratic operator. And this is the sum over J of Ji, Ji. So in other words, it's the quantum operator corresponding to the classical squared modulus of the angular momentum. What happens is that in a given irreducible representation J, this operator here is gauge invariant, namely is proportional to the identity matrix, but it's not the identity. It has the proportionality constant depends on the representation you're looking at, and is J times J plus 1. Okay, which is you remember that the first irreducible representations were 0, then 1/2, then 1, and the corresponding dimensionality of the Hilbert space of the vector spaces was 1, 2, 3, and this Casimir operator picks up values 0. It picks up values when you put 1/2 here, it gives you 3/4. When you put 1, it gives you 2. So it's a way to, it's always different when you change J. That's a monotonic expression. And so it gives you a way to characterize these irreducible representations. And that's the only thing I'm gonna need, okay? So let me consider the simplest geometrical operator, not the simplest in general, but the simplest for this theory, which is the area of a surface. So let me consider a surface sigma. And for simplicity, I'm assuming, to cut a long story short, I'm just assuming that this surface lies in the plane x1, x2, okay? So x3 is completely orthogonal to this surface sigma. So in general, this is just differential geometry. I can write the area of this surface as I pick up a parameterization of this area, and then I compute the determinant of the induced two metric, where the induced two metric means that you take the space-time metric and you project it along vectors which are tangent to the surface. Okay, this is just basic differential geometry. This vector here is a vector that is tangent to the surface. So in the simple case, where I'm just looking at this configuration here, the determinant of the induced metric is just, so the determinant of the induced metric is just J11 J22 minus J12 squared. And this time I'm not going to try to write it in terms of deltas as before, so to avoid another embarrassing situation. But I hope it shouldn't be hard for you to see that if we work in that particular choice of coordinates, you remember, in which we fix this part of the metric tensor to be just like that, then the determinant of this minor is precisely the determinant of the whole matrix times the inverse element in the corner there. So, and the inverse element, which you might be tempted to just call G-133, is actually the notation that is more properly used for technical reason is G-33, but with indices up, okay? So this is just algebra. If I have a matrix G mu nu, such that its determinant is G, and the matrix has this shape here, then the inverse element here is 1 over the determinant times its minor, right? Is algebraic complement, how do you call it? So it's just this formula here. But now let us recall that we have introduced this electric field precisely as that quantity that satisfies that GAB is equal to EAI EBJ delta IJ sum over I and J's. And then the electric field with indices up, you remember I told you this was a technical choice, but then now it turns out to be useful, is the determinant of this 3x3 matrix times the inverse of this matrix, so EAI. Now, by looking at this formula here, you see that G, the determinant, is equal to E squared. So this formula here, you can write it as E3J delta IJ. Namely, you can write it as E3I, E3J, okay? So, delta IJ. So some kind of norm. This is not a norm in space, but it's in these internal indices of the gauge algebra. So some kind of norm of this electric field. And now we know that in our theory that we are quantizing in the Schrödinger representation, the electric field is going to be turning to the functional derivative with respect to the connection. I hope you haven't forgotten, but we said that our initial Hilbert space, this one here, was an Hilbert space where we were representing the canonical algebra, which as a quantum algebra becomes this with the appropriate deltas in the usual Schrödinger picture, namely where the operator A becomes just the multiplication and the operator E becomes the derivative with respect to the configuration variable. And we're looking at functions on function of the configuration variable, say, with the caveats of the fact that this is actually a wave functional and this is a functional derivative, okay? But more or less that was the idea. So you can see, oh, and of course, let me be slightly more precise. Let's add those indices here. There's these two indices, and this is a function of x, and this is a function of x. So you see that this classical quantity here, by this Hatting prescription, is gonna be turned into two functional derivatives. So this functional prescription tells me that E, I'll use the arrow just in a second, EI3, EJ3, delta J is going to be turned as an operator in delta J functional derivative of respect to AI, and these are in, at the same point, x, times another functional derivative. Sorry, 3. The space index is now fixed to 3, J of x, okay? This is not the area operator yet, because notice that the area operator would be the integral over the x1, the x2, between the coordinates that we are attaching to our parametrization of the manifold of the square root of this operator here. Let me call this a hat, square root of this operator here, which depends, of course, on x1 and x2. Not on x3, because we are just looking at that surface, okay? So now notice that I'm acting on states, which are these pin network states, which depend on the connection only via, so a generic state cell V depends on the connection only via the exponential of the line integral of the connection, okay? So the functional derivative picks up the function in a given point, okay? So the function in a given point, if I have a function, if I act with the functional derivative on a function that depends on a function that is never touching the point, then this functional derivative is zero. Precisely like if I act with d over dx3 over a function that is only a function of x1 and x2, this is zero. This is what I'm generalizing. If I act over dA of the point P of a function of A that is never defined in P, as in this case here, then this would be, so here there's never P, I don't know what notation to use, this would give you zero. Is it intuitive or it's unclear? This is very important because it shows us that we only care if this state has a link that at least once touches the surface I'm looking at. Because you see, in here I have functional derivatives with respect to points which always lie on the surface. Where's my surface? Here. Okay? So anytime I'm acting on a state that has a connection someplace else in space, but it does not cross the surface, the functional derivative is going to give me zero. Precisely as every time I'm acting on a function that does not depend on this variable, then the partial derivative gives me zero. So this only picks up those states. It's only non-zero when evaluated on those states which cross the surface sigma. And they can cross an arbitrary number of times. Now, for simplicity, just let me consider the simplest case in which I have a state that crosses the surface sigma only once, okay? So I'm looking at a simplified picture which simplifies the mathematical analysis but not the physical interpretation. It simplifies the mathematical analysis because then I don't have to deal with the square root and with the integral. And so if I have a case in which I'm intersecting only once, then of all these integrals, I can forget of all the points except the one where I'm actually intersecting, okay? So this integral is gonna get only one contribution from precisely that point where the Wilson line of my spin network state intersects the surface. So I can just look for simplicity, I can forget about the square root, and just look at this operator here in that point. So I'm just gonna look at A, the operator A, in the point X, where X is here, is the point where that lies on the surface and where my and is the only point that is intersected by my spin network state, which can be arbitrarily complicated out there. I don't care. So I'm acting with this, and then I can only look. It's enough for me to just look at the piece of spin network that depends on the line integral of this connection. So inside my spin network state, there would be a line integral along this path of the connection times the generators in the representation. Let's call this link L in the representation JL. And this is the line integral along L. All the rest, this operator doesn't see it because as a functional derivative, it gives zero. So I can push through until I hit this piece, which is the only non-trivial piece. So I'm just focusing on this piece. And now I'm going to be a bit a bit sketchy, but just I want to give you an idea of what happens. So I have two derivatives like this, J acting on E to the line integral of AI and then the generators in the representation JL. What happens when I act with the, you think of these as, think of these as just a normal exponential. So think that I'm doing something like this. This is P e to the PX, okay? So think it precisely in the same, let's use this formal analogy. Then when I do the first derivative, I'm getting a piece JI coming down. So I get delta, so this other functional derivative, the piece JJ, sorry, came down. Don't ask me what happens with the three now is fixed. And then I still have the integral, and forget about this I am, sorry. Just by using formal analogy with this formula here. It is more complicated than this to give it really a precise mathematical term because these functional derivatives do not commute with what's inside here. So you have to be more precise. But I just want to give you a sketch idea that now when I act again, when I act with the second derivative here, I'm just getting p squared e to the px. And if these were vectors, and I was acting with di dj with a delta ij, here I will be getting the squared modulus, pi, and then pi, pi, right? Pi xi, sorry. So when I act again, I have a sum over ij with the identity. So what I'm getting is sums over I of ji, ji, and then the initial state. But ji over ji over these states here, over this state here, is precisely the Casimir. This guy here. So I know that actually, as an operator, this has eigenvalue j times j plus 1. So this is equal to the identity matrix times j times j plus 1. So the result of acting with A on a big spin network state that crosses only once that surface is the initial spin network state, so A acting on some complicated spin network state, is the initial spin network state times, and this is, sorry, on the link that is intersecting. So there's a little index there, times the initial spin network. So this tells us that this spin network state is an eigenstate of this operator A here, because by definition, and that its eigenvalues span a discrete spectrum. Precisely like the Casimir of SU2 is a discrete, as a discrete spectrum. A similar construction, even though it's more complicated, can be done. Well, first of all, here I've done a lot of simplifications and I've been very sketchy. But if you look at the details, it's not very complicated. A little bit more complicated is to look at what happens when you study the volume of a region as opposed to the area of a surface. In that case, the mathematics is a little bit more involved. And what you can see is that the surface, the area of the surface, depends on the links puncturing the surface, and it depends on the value of the spin associated to that link. When you act with the volume operator, the volume operator is going to be sensible, it's going to be sensitive to the intertwiners, to these other guys here. Why? Because the volume, you might remember from differential geometry that it's a cubic, well, or even by a formula like this, the volume is now, while this is quadratic in DE, the volume is cubic in DEs. And this you can, it should be sort of intuitive, because if you think of these E's as vectors pointing in different directions in space, you know that if you want to study the volume of a surface, the volume of a region, you need three non-parallel vectors pointing in three different regions of space. So in a sense, these the need of three vectors in three pointing in three different directions in space is mapped into the presence of three vectors pointing in three different directions in this algebra space. And you need the cubic operator, and this cubic operator is going to be sensitive to these intertwiner states here. So when you look, you have a spin network state, a complicated spin network state that might have many intersections. It might be knotted. It's just a graph. It might have a four-valve intersection here, a three-valve intersection here, and one here. On this kinematical spin network state, the geometrical picture of this state is that an area of any surface which is cut by this link will be proportional to this value here. A volume of a region around this node will be proportional to the value of the intertwiner associated with that node, and to a lesser extent also the value of the spins which are around this node, which are around the node. And what happens, you might ask, if I'm looking at the region around a node that is only trivalent? A region that, a node that is only trivalent has no intertwiner. And in fact, it happens that the volume associated with that region is zero in the theory. There's no intertwiner, the intertwiner is trivial, there's no contribution to the volume. The reason for this is that, in a sense, the volume is sensible to the non-commutativity of this algebraic structure. So, well, that would require more time, and it would be for another class. But anyway, this is the interesting picture that emerges, that you have this graph in space, and that regions around nodes have volumes coming from the intertwiner associated to that node, which is zero if the node is only trivalent. And these regions share links, and this link tell you what is the area of the surface between those two regions. To give you a picture, suppose you have two spheres that are, like, imagine these are two air balloons, and so they're pressed against each other. And then the theory at this level of before imposing the constraints tells you that the area of this common surface is given by the spin label associated to this link, and the volume of these two regions is given by the intertwiners associated with these two nodes. Okay? So this is how, at this kinematical level, the discretization of spacetime emerges. Notice there is a spacetime which is in some sense extremely singular, because if I now probe out of probe a region of space which has no links or no nodes in it, I'm always going to get no metric there. There's absolutely nothing. So for a given graph, this is a very highly distributional metric space, in the sense that only if you move along or intersect pieces of the graph, you're going to feel metric properties. If you don't, you don't see anything. There's no space-time metric there, which means that if you're interested in recovering a semi-classical description of space-time, where there's metric properties among all the points in space-time, you cannot use a simple graph like this. In fact, you cannot even use an extremely complicated graph. It's easy to prove that you are going to need to consider very complicated superposition of graphs if you want to even hope to be able to reconstruct a smooth geometrical manifold out of these spectra of geometric operators. And now, let me go back to this issue here. So this is at this level. We have done this first step. There's these two more steps to do in order to solve the theory. And notice that, as I said, this whole approach stems from the idea of taking this identification of the gravitational field with the space-time metric for as a serious statement about nature, taking it for what it might really mean, and then working out the consequences, trying to use what we know from ordinary quantum mechanics. Because apart from the fact that I'm using functional derivatives instead of normal derivatives, and the fact that I'm using SU2 instead of abelian electromagnetism, I hope that all the other concepts were basic concepts that you had already seen in quantum mechanics. And for what concerns the quantization of constraint systems, this Dirac procedure, I hope that you did that exercise for the timeless double pendulum, and I showed you what is the physical interpretation. In fact, so far in the last two classes, I've been focusing on technical issues. But let me now go back to the physical meaning of imposing the constraints. You remember what the let's go back to the timeless double pendulum. What was the physical meaning of that? That you had in the usual system, you would have the two pendula, and then you would have a time, and then you have a real Hamiltonian, and then you study the equations of motions as A as a function of T and B as a function of T. And then we say, but suppose now we don't have a system with a time. Well, we can still use, if we don't have an external watch, we can still decide to choose one of the two pendula as our clock variable and express the other one as a function of the first one. And this is an example of generativistic dynamics, in which case, instead of having a real Hamiltonian, you have an Hamiltonian constraint, namely a function of the two configuration variables that has to be equal to zero. So when you classically solve the Hamiltonian constraint, what you get is a dynamics, namely a relation between the configuration variables, which, as in the example you should work out explicitly, might depend on the initial conditions, for instance, or just ordinary classical mechanics. And the same thing should happen for the gravitational field. The presence of a constraint for the gravitational field means that when I'm looking at GAB as my configuration variable, there's something redundant. If I now study JA of B as a function of T, where T is my external parameter, you remember that 3+1 splitting we did. That 3+1 splitting was completely artificial, and the theory tells us that it was completely artificial by telling us that there's no physical meaning in the evolution of this function with respect to T. So what the Hamiltonian constraint tells us is that out of these configuration variables, there's one or a combination of those that can be taken as the clock. And then the others can be used, the dynamics can be studied through this constraint as evolution of the others with respect to the chosen clock. So this is the physical interpretation. And it goes in two steps. The first step is the imposition of this constraint. The imposition of, so remember that in principle, this is not just a function of T, but of course it's a function of T and the three spatial coordinates X. okay? What the first guy, those three vectors, sorry, these 3D vector here tells you is that there is no physical meaning in the choice of the spatial coordinates. The theory is the same under any change of local spatial coordinates. You remember, that was the idea of general covariance to be implemented that we began with. And what does it mean to the point of view of our graphs? Well, it means that if I have, what was the graph that we used? If I have this graph here, for instance, or if I move this graph along, or if I deform it, because by changing my coordinate system, I can arbitrarily deform graphs like this. For instance, I can change coordinates in such a way that this object looks like something like this. I can imagine a change of coordinates as a deformation, a continuous deformation, okay? In fact, I should imagine it as continuous as differentiable, but those are just mathematical details. What I'm really caring to say is the fact that if I, a priori, if the coordinates mattered, then I would say that the state defined by giving spins to this graph should be different physically than the state associated to this graph, okay? If there was a meaning in the coordinates, because remember that the state is characterized by choosing a graph and then assigning spins. And there's no doubt that this graph is different from this graph. They might have the same topology, the same connectivity, if you want. There's always two nodes connected by three links. But nevertheless, they're different by the way I've drawn them on the blackboard, okay? So, and in fact, what I've said in this construction of spin network state applies precisely for electromagnetism and gauge theories. As I told you, when you study quantum electromagnetism, you will not see these bases for two reasons. But you will see the ordinary basis of Fock states, which you haven't seen anyway yet. So anyway, when you study quantum electromagnetism, you will use another basis, which is called the Fock basis. And that is much more convenient because it has a direct physical interpretation. The states label photons. So it is more convenient and it is mathematically correct. Namely, it's a complete basis of your Hilbert space. This base sucks, because these states have no clear physical meaning. I mean, their meaning, you've seen it, is the exponential of the line integral of A, sorry, of A along a path gamma, okay? So physically, it's much less clear what this means with respect to a photon. But also mathematically, these states are a problem, because precisely for this reason that not just these two graphs are different, but also these and this one are different. And because this is a basis, by different, I mean that they are orthogonal. So this state is orthogonal to this one. But you see that this gives me a description of this Hilbert space that is huge, because you can imagine how many infinitesimal deformation I can do in three space, even without changing the spins or the shape of the, or the topology, the connectivity of the graph. You can see how many, the richness of these bases. So when you have, so in fact, what happens is that mathematically this basis is overcomplete. There's too many vectors in this basis. There's more vectors than the dimensionality of the Hilbert space I'm looking at. Even though speaking about infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, maybe that statement is confusing. But anyway, let me just pass you the message that when you're just looking at electromagnetism or gauge theory, you can derive the same basis. It's not used because it is not clearly physically interpretable and because mathematically it has a problem. This mathematical problem, you see that is automatically solved in general relativity, because in general relativity it teaches me that this state and this state, because they are just a change of coordinates, it's just a local deformation, they should be identified as the same physical state. There's no meaning in the choice of coordinates. If I change coordinates, namely I deform my graph, the state physically should be the same, precisely as in electromagnetism, if I make a gauge transformation, the physics should be the same. So a physical state satisfies this identity. Here, I want a physical state to satisfy the identity that if I compute it on that graph is equal to any diffeomorphism of the initial graph. Okay? So that problem of the huge redundancy could be cured by applying the same procedure in generativity, where I know that in fact those are just redundant states. They're not different physical states. And this procedure can actually be carried over, and it's a non-procedure in knot theory. And what you do is that you start with a graph, and then you use moves to try to see what is the irreducible structure of the graph. And by irreducible structure, we mean the fact that it's just encoded in its connectivity and its knotting. So for instance, no, that blackboard, I'm gonna need it. So for instance, this graph here, and I'm never gonna get it. And this graph here, which you can't really understand, so, oh, no, not this. So these two graphs are actually the same, because it's easy to, from a diffeomorphism point of view, because it's easy to see that I can take this branch and pull it inside. Okay, and if I pull it inside, then this just becomes this. Okay? And then I can certainly keep pulling until I flip it completely. And so I just have, from a diffeomorphism invariant point of view, the same graph. They are the same. The one I wanted to draw that is not the same is this. Now this one you cannot do the same trick. And in spite of the fact that both of these graphs have no intersections, this one is not knotted, this one is knotted, this is called the trefoil knot. So these two graphs, even up to identifying all the continuous deformations, these four graphs can be identified to the same one. This one cannot be identified to this one. So this, given an assignment of a spin, is a single physical, well, physical, almost physical state in this space here. And the trefoil knot is an independent state, okay? So I go here by just considering knot classes. And it is interesting that these knot classes, so this is one of the most complicated and still open problems in mathematics, namely classifying knots, namely giving a set of coordinates such that to each coordinate there's a single knot that corresponds to it. But anyway, the study of them has been out there since a long time, at least since the end of the 19th century, because Kelvin, the guy of the temperature, he thought, he wasn't very happy about Mendeleev element table, and he thought that the description, the chemical description of matter could be explained by assuming that an ether existed and that this ether knotted in different ways. And because the knotting properties cannot be exchanged, different knots of ether would correspond to different chemical elements, to different elements. So the first efforts of classifying knots go back to 130 years, and the task is still open. It hasn't been finished. But that's a problem of mathematics. The physics is to some extent clear. What we care of is just not how these things are displaced in space, because there's no meaning in the space coordinates, but just in the way these things are knotted and the way they intersect. And then there's the last mysterious step, namely the fact that now, out of this theory, out of these things, there's one that I can use as a clock and express the others in terms of, as an evolution in terms of this clock. And the effort to try to go on and impose also this final constraint is still hasn't succeeded because of the complicacy related to this constraint that does not have a linear structure such as the Gauss constraint and the diffeomorphism, spatial diffeomorphism constraint. This one is nonlinear. And, well, this is called the canonical approach, the approach in which you try to do this. But as you will probably learn very soon when you take quantum field theory, the canonical approach is not always the best thing to deal with interacting systems, to deal with dynamics. There is a much more powerful framework that, even though it stems from the canonical approach, then it can be justified independently. And this is called the covariant or functional approach. And it's called covariant because instead of using the splitting of space and time and assigning a special role to time, which is the thing that tells you what are the conjugate momentum, treats space and time at the same way. And so this functional, given the difficulties of trying to impose the Hamiltonian constraint for this approach, this covariant or functional framework has been suggested also for loop quantum gravity. And this is what goes by the name of the spin form formalism. It uses the fact, and this is probably the last thing I'm going to tell you, that something is known about this operator and is known the way it acts on these knotted spin network states. The way it acts, and this has to do with its algebraic structure and the way it is transformed into a functional derivative operator, just as the area. The way it acts is that, first of all, just like the volume operator, this is sensitive only to the nodes in a spin network state. And what it does is that it takes a node, so let's say the simple case like this, and then if you act with this constraint, if you act with the area or the volume, those are the spin networks are eigenstates. So they give you a number times the initial spin networks. They are not eigenstates of the Hamiltonian constraint, of course, because actually we are precisely interested in understanding those particular states, which as an action, they give you zero. So if you act on a generic state, I'm using this ket notation just to focus on this node, what I'm going to get out of this is a modified graph. In this sense, it's not an eigenstate. I've changed the graph. And the graph is modified as follows. The node is split into two additional nodes. So maybe the ket notation is a bit confusing here. Let me get rid of it. What happens is that under action of the Hamiltonian constraint, this of the Hamiltonian operator, this goes into this graph. And so now imagine that this is part of a simple graph you're starting with. You're starting with this graph that we already seen, this simple graph here. And we have our parameter time that we know it has no physical meaning, but we use it to study the action of this operator here. What's going to happen is that when we act with the operator, this node will be split, broken up like this. This is now challenging drawing. So let's say I was starting from this spin network. I'm going to end up with this spin network. Oh, well, I started actually with an even easier one. So I've started with this spin network. Let us focus on this node. This node is like this. At some point, the Hamiltonian operator acts, and this node becomes like this. And so at a later stage, the graph has evolved into something that looks like this. If I now try to make a 3D movie of this, that's what you're going to see. And the way this thing looks like is that it's a 2D generalization of a graph, where now instead of having only nodes connected by links, you also have surfaces. Because you can see this cylinder, you can see a sort of plane inside this cylinder. And then you can see also the other planes which open up when I act with the Hamiltonian constraint here. So these so this 2D version of a graph has, and recall that a spin network has spins assigned to each link. So if I'm now evolving, a link is becoming a surface in time. So these spins are now associated with the faces. And the intertwiners that were associated with the more than trivalent nodes would now be associated with edges, with links. So a spin foam, because there's spins associated to what is hoped to give a description of Wheeler's intuition of space-time foam, can be thought of as an evolution of a spin network. And the idea behind the spin foam formalism is to find those foams that correspond to the implementation of the Hamiltonian constraint. Well, remember from the exercise that by implementation of the Hamiltonian constraint, what I meant was to find those states that satisfy H acting on the states equals zero. And namely, remember that I can think of these as a projector from HD to H physical. And this projector, formally speaking, is some kind of delta of H. And you remember that in the case of the timeless double pendulum, actually was a real delta. No, you remember, because we gave a representation of it in that simple example as the integral in the lambda from minus infinity to plus infinity of e to the I lambda, the Hamiltonian constraint. You remember in the exercise is really, and this you can think of it really as delta of H, formally. What happens in this field theory, not anymore a quantum mechanical system, is that you can give of this formal projector an expression in terms of a path integral. And this path integral is described in terms of the spin foams. And the idea behind the spin foam formalism is to find the right imposition, the right projector to go to the physical state. That would give the dynamics of general relativity, namely, it would give at the quantum level a way to, if you select a clock, express the evolution of the other variables, physical variables, in terms of this clock. And I'm past my time, so I thank you for your time, and I hope that I got you interested in the field. Thank you.